Hey folks, the Other People Podcast is a listener-supported program. All episodes of this show are entirely free, nearly 500 episodes and counting, all available free of charge. If you would like to support the Other People Podcast this holiday season, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thank you.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jeez, dude, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person. Just
hey, everybody. How's it going? Welcome to the Other People right. Podcast. I'm Brad Listy. Here in Los Angeles, California. Very excited about today's show. I have Daniel A. Hoyt on the program. He's got a novel out called This Book Is Not For You. It is available from DeZank Books. It is the winner of the inaugural DeZank Fiction Prize, and it is also the official December selection of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is, of course, my online culture magazine and literary community. It has its own monthly book club. If you would like to sign up for that over at TheNervousBreakdown.com. So Daniel A. Hoyt and I coming up in just a moment. Before we get there, I do want to address some orders of business. The first being that the holiday episode is coming up. There's a holiday spectacular. It's a kind of a tradition here on the Other People Podcast. I think for the past 3 or 4 years, I've done a holiday spectacular episode right around this time. And it's coming up. I just got to do the edit on the episode. It's a bit of an edit intensive endeavor, and I have to find the time. I have to carve out the time in my schedule to get that done, but trust that it will happen. Fingers crossed. Okay. So, otherwise I've got some mail from a listener named Sam. He says, dear Brad, I listened to episode 490 with Jarrett Middleton. That was a great episode. It was so good that I actually listened to it twice, which I've never done with any podcast before. When you two talked about the nature of death, one of you mentioned an Alan Watts quote. I can't even remember what it was, which reminded me of another Watts quote that I always come back to when thinking of death. He says, quote, "We do not come into this world. We come out of it as leaves from a tree." Wow. I just got very enthused there when I said come out of it. So let me start again. Alan Watts says, quote, "We do not come into this world. We come out of it as leaves from a tree, as the ocean, quote unquote, waves, the universe, quote unquote, peoples. Every individual is an expression of the whole realm of nature, a unique action of the total universe. This fact is rarely, if ever, experienced by most individuals. Even those who know it to be true, in theory, do not sense or feel it, but continue to be aware of themselves as isolated egos inside bags of skin." End quote. And then Sam continues, "I always take this quote to be comforting regarding death, because it's like, you know, how can you be afraid of something that you spawned out of? The universe. You came out of it, not into it." Thanks, Sam. So thank you, Sam. I appreciate the letter. It's making me realize, you know, or at least it's reminding me, you know, once again, that I am one of these people who I think understands in theory that I'm one with the universe, that I am a, you know, like an inseparable part of all that is, at least on some, you know, strange subatomic level. And yet I cannot really feel it. I don't have like a lived experience of this. I haven't had that, you know, that nirvana or that epiphanic or that whatever you want to call it experience. I'm an isolated ego inside of a bag of skin is what I'm saying. And yet I feel like if you try to have the experience of felt oneness with all that is, it's like you're forcing it. You can't force it. It's sort of got to happen. But maybe you can do things like meditation or what, you know, what else can you do to sort of seed the field and, you know, lay the groundwork? You know what I'm talking about. Maybe there's ways to sort of prepare yourself. So it's interesting too, that you wrote to me, Sam, about this, very subject, because earlier in the week, I got another letter from a different listener who wrote to me in a way that I cannot paraphrase. So I'm not being coy here. I don't mean to, keep this from you guys, but like, there's absolutely no way for me to like pull quote this letter or excerpt it or paraphrase it. It's like this giant letter that this guy wrote to me. And he was talking about this very thing as a person who actually has experienced this, and I think quite credibly. And I think the main reason why I say so is just the quality of the letter and his description of his experience. But then, you know, the other thing is that he had this experience in the wake of a horrific accident that left him paralyzed. And I think, you know, from all that I've read and all that I've heard on this subject over the years, one of the things that I think often catalyzes this sort of experience, based on what I've gathered, is like an experience where you sort of have to surrender. It's like an extreme situation, and often a state of extreme suffering is what brings it on. So anyway, I mean, it's like I've had some very interesting mail this week, is my point. And then as a capper, this evening I came home from work. I'm recording this at night, so just a couple of hours ago, I was sitting and eating dinner, and my wife Carrie comes up to me and she hands me a piece of paper, and she says, "Hey, you know, I thought that this was a Christmas card. The envelope had no return address, so I opened it, but it's to you." And she hands me this letter, and I read it, and it says, "Dear Mr. Listy, thank you for your letter concerning our president and my comments in that regard. I have found no joy in reaching a point where commenting in such a way became necessary, but this situation demands all of us not be numbed and duped by such behavior. Our country is at stake. It is uplifting to realize that there are many others like yourself who demand more from whomever may occupy the office of the presidency, and certainly not one who brings such shame in so many ways. Be safe and never settle. Sincerely, Greg Popovich." So for those of you who are basketball fans, Greg Popovich is the coach of the San Antonio Spurs. He's a Hall of Fame coach. He's won multiple championships. He's one of the most successful coaches in the United States of America at any level, and a very smart guy. And, you know, many weeks ago, I would say like 8 to 10 weeks ago, I wrote him a letter. And the reason that I wrote to him is because, you know, if you pay attention to sports at all, or, you know, you might have even seen this on social media in passing, Popovich has on more than one occasion stood in front of microphones and been very eloquent in speaking truth to power to Donald Trump, which is unusual behavior for a sports coach. It's not something we normally see on ESPN. It's not something we normally see in our culture, where a sports coach is engaging national politics explicitly in a post-game interview, to say the least. But I feel that the situation that we're in, the times that we're living in, calls for it. We're in an extreme situation. And I just was very relieved, frankly, to hear Popovich talking like that, because I feel like that's the sort of thing we need. We need people in the culture who have platforms and who have, you know, some influence, and who, especially those who are able to be really eloquent about it and to speak with some authority, and who have built, some trust within their communities or within their fan bases or whatever. We need that sort of thing. So I think what I was doing was I was writing to him with the idea that, like, I need to encourage him, and we all should be encouraging people who have big megaphones to keep speaking up, because we need them to do so. And I was also anticipating that he was probably going to have to suffer some backlash, you know, especially coaching down in Texas. Like, God only knows, like, half his fan base probably disagrees with him. You know, I think, I don't know, but I wanted to make sure that he heard from me. That was like the feeling that I had. And, you know, it's an extension of what I've been doing this whole year, where I've been writing a lot of letters to people as a sort of, as a way to counteract the negativity, like, swirling in our country and in our culture. And I felt like it's a great way to get away from my phone and get away from social media and do something constructive with my time and communicate in a way that feels personal and not superficial or you know what I'm talking about. And he wrote back to me. So that's been this week. That's just this week, the letters that I've gotten. And I'm not doing justice to the one that I talked about in the middle, because I didn't read it. But that one's sort of the fulcrum of my whole week. And it's gotten me thinking in a lot of different ways that are good, you know. And I appreciate everybody listening. I appreciate everybody listening and those who take the time to write to me. And I appreciate Greg Popovich. He's a busy guy. He's an NBA coach, you know, taking time to sit down and respond to my weird little note. So anyway, let's get on with the program, shall we? Daniel A. Hoyt is my guest. His novel is called This Book Is Not For You, winner of the DeZank Fiction Prize, December pick for the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. It is available now from DeZank Books. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen. This is Daniel A. Hoyt.
So, you know, it was, I mean, the kind of suburbs where it was almost totally, you know, middle class, some lower middle class, a lot of upper middle class, a lot of professionals who did work in Boston or in the surrounding companies, and, you know, things like a almost complete lack of diversity in the town and in terms of, you know, ethnic and racial makeups and lots of WASPs. So it, you know, in a strange way, it was all American in the way that we know all American is false and worrisome. So I was really glad to, even though, you know, my like upbringing was fine, I was glad to get out into the world and move half a continent away and live in a place, even though it was, you know, the middle of Missouri, but because it was a college town and I was going to university that did have more and different people and more and different opportunities. And my parents were totally, you know, had a WASPy background, but neither went to college.
What did they do for a living?
Yeah, so my dad was a bank manager, and he worked at the local branch and managed it for, you know, 35 years or so. But because he didn't have a college degree and perhaps because of his own sort of lack of ambition, or maybe not that, but maybe anxiety and worry or what have you. So that's where he sort of stopped in terms of going up the food chain. And my mom, my sister and I were younger, she was at home, but then she had various jobs and often did bookkeeping. And she worked for ADT, the security company. But then for most of the time, she worked in the local town hall. And that was her hometown where she grew up. So she knew tons of people and did bookkeeping there. Like my thinking about my parents, like my mom, she's a very good cook, but she's the most boring cook in the world. So like salt and pepper are these exotic spices. So yeah, that's right. And when I moved away, like there are all these things that, you know, I got to discover, like hummus. What the fuck is hummus? Or baba ganoush. Like
you moved to Manhattan, Kansas, and discovered hummus.
Yeah. That was Columbia, Missouri at the time.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. Who does that? Right. You moves to the middle of the Midwest, Columbia, Missouri, and discovers the world.
So what kind of kid were you?
Of course I read a lot and I, you know, I was pretty quiet, and did love to read starting in probably about, yeah, first grade or second grade, although like from leaving kindergarten, and there's this weird story about me leaving kindergarten and not wanting to leave kindergarten. And then on the first day of first grade, and I think I can remember it I can remember because it's been told to me that on the first day of first grade, like I had a screaming, crying fit and I was holding onto a pole outside the elementary school and my mother was trying to rip me off of it, of course, to get me into class. And apparently what I said is that I would never be able to read. And so I was wrong, you know, like I guess I figured it out at some point. So, from that, I think I was, pretty sheltered and wanted to be at home, and I like to imagine things, and I still have a weird box of, like a shoebox somewhere in the house of like you know, like hundreds and hundreds of drawings that I did, and just like, you know, stupid Dungeons and Dragons type stuff and Star Wars type stuff. And I still have all my Lego sets, which, you know, were such great fun, the spaceship sets that came out at that time. So I think, I like to live in my head a lot. In high school and things like that, then, you know, I always liked music, and that's when I started to get into rock and roll. And my first concert was the band The Cult, famous for She Sells Sanctuary, and it was at the Orpheum Theater in Boston. I think I was 15. And of course, that was huge and so important. The Divinyls actually opened up. And that was just sort of great and amazing. And The Cult was a terrific live band. So I think I was lucky that that was my show.
Yeah, I had Huey Lewis in the news. So I think you should.
how was Huey live?
I've told this story on the show, I think once or twice, but I was like, my family had just moved to Indiana, and I think my parents felt bad. And so they're like, we're going to take the kids to a concert. And my parents were clueless when it came to rock and roll or anything like that. And so they got us tickets, but our tickets were behind the stage. So like, we were like looking at the back of Huey Lewis. And then like a couple times during the show, he would like turn around and like sing to the back of, you know, the stadium or whatever. And it was, it was about what you would expect.
Yeah. How old were you then?
I was like 11. I think 11 years old. And like, remember that song, The Heart of Rock and Roll?
Yeah, of course. It's still beating, right?
Yeah. Right. Remember how he goes through and he sings all the different cities where he's like New York, New York and Boston. And, you know, he does all that stuff. Yeah. Well, we were in Indianapolis, which does not factor into the song as it, you know, as it was recorded. But of course, when he's singing live in Indianapolis, he like wedged it in there. Everyone went crazy. So it's like,
yeah,
it was like that sort of thing.
You know, it's funny because in the literature of rock and roll, we talk about moments like that a lot. And with the idea of the aesthetic of recognition and thinking about how, of course, we see it as this great literary thing that, oh my gosh, I saw this, I figured out this reference to Virgil and I get it and I feel great. But rock and rollers use this all the time with their appeals to our to the places we live, and then the best, of course, is when they play a cover and we recognize that and that great joy that we have. So hats off to Huey for thinking of the people in Indianapolis. Yeah, I don't know where he'd fit it in because they're all like two beats in that song, I think.
And yeah, it was very delicate, but he managed to pull it off. And
he's a pro. All the news are pros. Yeah.
So did you play in bands, and did you have any siblings, or was it just you growing up? I think you mentioned
I have an older sister, and she has musical talent. She played trumpet, and she has athletic talent too. She was a softball pitcher and pretty damn good. Me, I have no talent in terms of like athleticism or music. And in music, it's particularly galling because I love it so much. But I like 15. So that same year when I went to see The Cult, I bought an electric guitar and an amp, and I still have both somewhere, just like a cheap PV amp. I thought just by like owning these things that I would acquire the ability to play them. But it doesn't work out that way. So I have no rhythm. I can't sing. I guess I can sometimes clap along.
that's about like me too. You know, the truth of it is that, I mean, I know that there's something, there's such a thing as talent when it comes to anything. But for these purposes, like for like a musical instrument, there's such a thing as having like an innate ability with an instrument and, you know, an ability to pick it up faster than other people. But even then, to get really good at an instrument, you have to sort of be obsessive, and you have to practice obsessively, and you have to like to do that. I guess it's the same with writing or anything, but I don't know. I guess there, in my head, I want to believe that like Jimi Hendrix just picked up the thing and could play, and maybe he could, but I feel like he probably just sat there noodling with it like 5 hours a day, like everybody else who's great at it.
Yeah, and that's what I think you're right on, that All the real musicians I know, well, sure, they have some sort of sense in their brain that maybe things are a little more intuitive. But no, they practiced a ton and it mattered to them, and they cared about it enough to, you know, push their fingers into the strings and get the bar chords down and figured out the right tunings and played with different people and asked for advice. And yeah, and you're right. And like sitting and noodling, like, I assume that my friends who can actually play guitar, well, they always had a guitar in their hands. If they were watching stupid MASH reruns, they were messing around too.
So what were some of the big bands for you? Like you mentioned the Cult, but like, were there, like, what are the formative bands for Daniel Hoyt?
Yeah. So, well, there's one band that I think was hugely important, but now, of course, I can't stand, which is U2. And I was at, it's funny because it was just, and I'm only thinking of them because of the reunion, the Joshua Tree reboot tour that they just did. And I went to two of the Joshua Tree tours back in 86, or was it 87? And they were great and political. And I think when I considered guitar players, I feel like the Edge doesn't get his due at times. And maybe it's because of Bono is always yelping and pushing the Edge to the side, but that distinctive peeling sound. In that time period too, like, a great Boston band, the Del Fuegos, which their song, Don't Run Wild, still means so much to me. And in that time, I'm thinking about, growing up, and of course it was the age, like the mid 80s and the age of MTV, but we were one of these families that didn't have cable television. My parents, you know, we probably made like a solid middle class living, but my parents like saved everything, and then they were so frugal, so we didn't have cable. But for a short time, Boston had a local video channel called V66, and they had local VJs from rock radio stations, and they couldn't play all the videos. So like I did not see Thriller because they didn't have the rights to play it. But local bands like the Del Fuegos got to, you know, star on this channel. And so it's so much of it is wrapped up in that nostalgia and that sense of place and that, and the idea of the Del Fuegos too. Like I knew that they were a local band, but also like an indie band, and they didn't belong to everyone, in the way that like, hey, the Cars, well, the Cars belong to the entire United States or the world. And the same with U2. But a band like the Del Fuegos, no, that belonged to the people who watched V66. And it's funny because an old buddy of mine from high school, he actually has started a once a week radio show where he's trying to recapture the old days of Boston rock when there was a great radio station called WBCN, which was album oriented rock and broke all kinds of new bands. And Boston used to have a great radio station, WFNX, which was affiliated with the Boston Phoenix, the alternative newspaper, neither of which exist anymore. So that's why I think about like what you do, Brad, and like reach out to the world and interview people and talk about indie books and talk about music. Like this is a vital, vital literary and arts oriented service that we used to get all the time on corporate radio.
Yeah, it's like that, there's not so many outlets on the mainstream dial for this sort of stuff, for sure.
Yeah. So, so those are the bands. The other I think about is that's probably when I discovered Springsteen, and so many of his early stuff, of course, is about being a young person and growing up and fucking things up and figuring things out. And then his great sort of huge live album set came out, I think when I was like a junior or senior, and all his terrific stories were there about, you know, playing the guitar on the roof because of his dad yelling at him. So it was great to discover his music then.
Are you still a fan?
You know, I'm probably not quite as much. And there was a point when I just sort of stopped buying Springsteen, and maybe it's because it didn't speak to me in the same way, or maybe it's because I just kept on discovering new and different bands, and you can only buy, you know, so many CDs or only have so much time to listen. I still appreciate what he does. I do think about that weird sense of his life, because of course he's this multi millionaire, and when he's on tour, he's staying in these great hotels, you know, that he's the 0.1%, but he's still trying to speak for everyone, and I appreciate that, but I also then there's part of me that thinks, well, there's a falsehood to it. I wonder that too with his live show. I've never seen him live, and of course, you know, it sounds like he's great, but there's part of me that thinks I'd be sitting there and think it's a shtick, and I don't think I'd want to, since I'm already anticipating that would feel like a shtick, I think it might be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I wouldn't want that to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like he grew up, hard scrabble. So at least he knows that. And then he was poor when he was like, what, in his early 20s or whatever, but he's lived, high on the hog for a long time. I think he knows that as well as anyone. I guess the question is like, how long can you be wealthy? Or like, does being wealthy for a long period of time have a blinding effect? Is there any way to counter that? Like, do you lose touch when you're that comfortable and that insulated from like the kind of common discomforts and stresses that almost everybody else has to deal with? You know what I'm saying? Like,
I do. Yeah. And Brad, I think it's like this great and huge question, because we're seeing it in the world and well, particularly in the United States, right, where we have this sense where there's this upper class that we don't even know about, where you know they have their own social circles and their own, perhaps soon, their own special tax codes, and their lives are nothing like. Hey, my life, even though I'm squarely upper middle class now, but you know, I mow my fucking lawn and walk to work and drive a 2000 Chevy S10 that I got from my dad when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and I'll drive it until it dies, and so sadly and maybe, you know, and it's probably not fair, because Springsteen is this great artist, but I just can't imagine that he wouldn't lose something, and that maybe the stories that he is telling have to become more fictional, or maybe he can tap into that hardscrabble youth. And of course it was totally true. And like, when I listen to his old stuff, I believe every word, and I love the Nebraska album, and so much of that, he's of course fictionalizing, telling other people's stories. And I believe it. So maybe I need to just think of him in that way, that he's a fiction writer and he's great at it. So next time he tours, I'm going to go and convince myself that way.
Just try not to think of him in Five Star Splendor as he's
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Right.
So were you raised with any religion? Did you grow up in a religious household? I mean, Massachusetts, I'm automatically thinking Irish Catholic, but maybe that wasn't it.
Yeah, no, you know, so, really, not at all. And it's pretty unusual that my mother, she remains, and when I do her taxes, she gives like $10 or $15, or sometimes more, $50, to the Congregational Church where she was allegedly a member. But I think like I could count how many times I went to church on one hand as a child, and really I I don't think my mom would say this in these terms, but she's an atheist and doesn't believe. And I do think she'll say something like, when you're dead, you know, you end up in the ground. And my dad, well, I think a lot about my dad because mainly what he did was work. And I think worry and, my amateur diagnosis is that he was clinically depressed for his whole life. So he had no interest in really anything. So I don't think he had any spiritual beliefs. It's funny that, actually when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and had to go live in assisted living, that's when he did get prescribed an antidepressant, which really did wonders. And for a short time, he showed an interest in other things despite his really failing brain. And he did talk about, he did go to church a few times with one of my aunts, his older sister. And that seemed to matter to him. And at times, so at one point he wandered off and it was horrible and got lost. He was allowed to walk on the grounds. But then he wandered away. So then he had to move to a dementia ward where you're locked in essentially. And I think this is the time when I had to tell him that he was moving back to the dementia ward. And at first he was really mad. And that's sort of like sadly, my major memories of him are him being mad. At first he was really mad, but not in too bad a way. And then we talked the next day and he said, "I'll do whatever I need to do to stay alive." And it was this, and I'd never heard him think about things like that or never heard him, you know, think about, you know, death or existence. So it was this sort of weird moment. My guess is he really didn't believe. You know, I don't say it a lot because I don't want it to like alienate my students and things like that, but I'm an atheist and I'll talk about this with individual students in my office and things like that. But I believe deeply in sort of ethics and morality and our commitment to others, but I think we make our own meaning. And I try to think about that when I'm working on fiction or when I'm teaching a class that, hey, this matters because we say it matters and let's do this and let's try to find beauty and let's try to think about the sadness of our lives and understand it and reflect on it. But yeah, I guess I'm like my mom when we're dead, it's the end of pain, and you end up on the ground.
Is there any kind of like, do you have any sense of like an overarching connective cosmic thing happening, or is it just a massive void out there?
You know, man, Brad, I didn't know we were going to go this deep.
Yeah. This is what I do.
You know, I don't think of it in a cosmic way, but I do think of it as this humanistic connection that we create and make and our relationships with others and how we care for others and how we live our lives and what we want our lives to represent. So I do see it as this human made construction. And there are times when, it must be really great to have faith. And what a buoy when you're in deep water to be able to hold on to that and float. But I don't feel it. And it's funny because, one of the book projects that I'm working on is a nonfiction book about the fifth down game, which was a famous football game in 1990 when the refs made a mistake and they gave Colorado an extra fifth down against the University of Missouri.
All right. I remember that. I went to University of Colorado, so that's like part of the lore.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That's what. So you know, of course, then that Bill McCartney was the the Colorado coach. So I got a chance to interview him a few years ago, and Bill McCartney, not only coached at Colorado and that year with the fifth down game, they won a share of the national championship. But he started the Promise Keepers, this right. Christian group. And so he is this like central casting could not have done it better, but he's the total summation of both a football coach and like an old school preacher. So he has this sort of gripping personality, and sitting there in this Panera, and neither one of us ate, but, you know, drinking out of these huge Panera cups of coffee, and he's like telling me about how if you ask God for faith, he will give it to you, right? And I didn't come on and tell him that I'm atheist, because he right away could tell that I was open to listening to him, and I am, and I admire that he has this faith, and in a certain way I even admire that he asked me to take that risk. But what I didn't say to him, of course, because I just wanted him to talk and get all his stories and not my jibber jabber. But I didn't say, but Bill, what if this is the one fucking time when God doesn't pick up, right? So I don't know what you'd say to that. I think he'd be pissed if I swore. And a lot of my students have faith, and care about it deeply.
You're teaching like creative writing and so on and so forth at Kansas State in Manhattan, Kansas, which I have to like point out, for a guy who does a literary show, I talk to so many writers from New York. It's nice to be talking to somebody who's from Manhattan, Kansas, instead of
it's the Little Apple.
That's right.
And we have at midnight, the ball drops, but it is indeed a Little Apple.
So what kind of students are you getting? A lot of farm kids? Because you don't probably get a ton of kids from out of state, do you?
Not a ton, but there's probably, I guess that like 10% or so. But the thing about it, and one of the things that I preach all the time about Kansas and the Midwest in general, is it is way more diverse than people think. So my students, we have I have students from Kansas City, Kansas, and then also, some from over on the Missouri side, Kansas City, Missouri, but then the huge suburbs of Kansas City, Missouri, which essentially is like one big Panera, right? So many of those students, and it's Johnson County, and their parents, have upper middle class jobs, and they come here. And then we do have rural students who have, a graduating class of 100 or a graduating class of 25. There's a growing Latino population here, of course. So it's more diverse than you'd think. And of course, grad students, we get, grad students from everywhere. My students are, it's a richer and more interesting student body than people might originally think. And I think the same thing about the landscape of Kansas too. We have cities here and we have these rich, strange college towns like Lawrence, Kansas is, where I got my PhD, is this great weird college town where the adult kickball league just gave $10,000 to charity, and they have this adult kickball league where like thousands of people go to the Sunday night game of the week. So it has and there are all these moments too where Lawrence was close to becoming the next Seattle in terms of rock bands, and then where I live, Kansas is not flat. We're in the Flint Hills, so it's beautiful and hilly. And Western Kansas is flat and sometimes seems desolate, but there's a beauty to that too, that there's this huge big sky. Like, no, fuck you, Montana. We have the big sky.
Yeah.
It goes forever. Yeah.
One of my best friends in college, she grew up on a huge farm in Goodland, Kansas, right there near the Colorado border. And
we'd go
through there, and that's, far as the eye can see, that's the big sky, Kansas.
You turn everywhere. And, yeah, it, and it just, it's amazing sometimes. Hey, so Brad, so you moved to Indianapolis when you were 11. So where did you grow up from, and why did your parents go to the Midwest?
Well, yeah, so I was born in Milwaukee. So I kind of split my childhood between Milwaukee and Indiana, 8 years in each place. So first half would be Milwaukee, and then there was like a 2 year interlude where we lived out in San Francisco. And then we went back to Milwaukee, and then we went to Indiana. And it was just my dad's job. You know, that was all. My parents are from Louisiana. So,
okay.
But I was raised in the Midwest. I mean, that's my milieu. And then when I went to Colorado for college, my two roommates in college were both from Kansas City. So, and I used to drive back and forth from Colorado to Indiana and would cut right through Kansas, the entire east to west breadth of the state on I-70. So,
man.
That's a haul.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's it. That can be, particularly at the end of like a college semester, that can be a long drive.
That's what that's what pod is for, or at least that's what it was for back in the day.
right, yeah.
It's a straight shot, you know. You're pretty much just like straight shot for about 6.5-7 hours. So let's get back to, I want to get back to kind of tracing the line of, your youth and then transitioning from being this sort of like music obsessed, high school student to getting out to, what did you say? University of Missouri to study journalism like that. I remember hearing about the University of Missouri's journalism program when I was in high school and was sort of, you know, writerly. And I think my parents were trying to like advise me and, probably should have taken their advice, but it was like, it's one of those places that, you know, if you're interested in journalism, you can do a heck of a lot worse than Missouri. It's got sort of a legendary journalism program. So how did that happen? Like, how did you wind up there coming from, suburban Boston?
So, it was kind of weird because I think when my mother probably had this idea that I would go to like Bowdoin College or Colby College or something like that, one of the, you know, New England liberal arts colleges. And I think, you know, and some of it, it's like me trying to do some kind of archaeological journey and dig up my past. I think I knew that I wanted to go to a big sort of state school, and I don't know why that mattered to me, but it did. Maybe it was because I started to become a basketball fan then, and it was the idea of going to a place that had big time basketball. So I applied to, you know, I don't know how many, I think, well, first I applied to University of North Carolina, which probably was totally basketball related. And I applied for early admission, and then they waitlisted me. So, of course, it was this crushing thing because it would have been super easy my senior year because you apply to early admission back then, you get in and you're done, right, because you have to accept. So then, I applied a bunch of other places, and I think it was in March or so that I then had my top two choices, and I applied to some on the East Coast, like NYU, and NYU wanted to give me, you know, a $2,000 scholarship, which, you know, sure, that's fine, except where's the $28,000 coming from? Well, right, you know, although I knew it probably would have come from my parents' savings. That's what they were saving for. So I went to visit University of Michigan and University of Missouri and was accepted at both of them, and they both had journalism programs. And that's why, of course, I applied to Missouri because of its reputation. So I applied to both of them and went to visit and went to Michigan. And I remember sitting at a table, like a welcome table, for this orientation, and sitting with a kid who went to prep school and his mom, and they were super nice, but I'm just like, these are not my people. And it was pouring rain. Then the next day I flew down to Missouri and hey, it's Missouri and everyone's super friendly and nice. And the sun was shining and it was 70 degrees and hey, that was it.
That sold you.
That sold me, right? And so I'm lucky because it actually was a great, great place to become a journalist. And the Missouri J School, they have this great belief in actually just being a journalist. And of course, which is how I used to do it, you know, 50 years ago, you went to work as a copy boy and then they let you do some writing and you just did it and became a journalist. Well, that's what you do at Missouri I did the print journalism, sequence, which meant that, hey, as a junior and senior, I worked for their daily newspaper run by the J School. And you'd take a class and work for 30 hours a week, writing articles and learning how to edit. And the editors are people who have had industry careers, often, people have had great industry careers and they run you through the ropes so it was great. And it was, you know, I learned so much about writing and about story, and you had to do it all the time. And at that point, I was a sports reporter. So there was always the sense that, hey, well, you know, most sporting events have some sort of climax, but you also have to make it a human experience for people. And luckily, this was back in the day before everyone knew everything about every single game going on because of the internet. So you had to tell a story to people. And that was a great, great experience. You know, my decision making might have been flawed as a 17-year-old, in terms of picking a school, but it worked out pretty great.
So yeah, what kind of journalism did you do professionally? I mean, you talked a little bit about interviewing McCartney, and you talked just a second ago about sports journalism. So is that the focus for you, or
First, when I was working for the University of Missouri's J School newspaper, which is separate from the student newspaper, I was a sports reporter and then also did sort of sports editing. And then my senior year, I worked as a correspondent for the Kansas City Star. So I also covered all kinds of sports stories then. So that the main reporter who didn't live in Columbia would always have someone on the ground and do reporting and help out at games. So I did tons of reporting then. After that, I got my master's degree and taught in Romania at a university for a semester. But when I came back, I got jobs mainly as a sports copy editor. So working these, you know, till midnight or 1 a.m. and sometimes 2 a.m., just putting out the stories, and sports happens every single night and happens on the West Coast. So it's this weird combination of having to do something really meticulous and tedious, you know, copy editing and making sure things are correct and asking questions, but also having that weird adrenaline rush. So I did that at the other daily paper in Columbia, Missouri, which is this weird small college town that has tons and tons of media because of the J School. And then I did that in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where I was a sports copy editor. But then I also did news editing there. And when I left La Crosse, I went to Kansas City, Missouri. And at that point, the Kansas City Star was one of the best sports sections in the country. And Joe Posnanski and Jason Whitlock were the columnists at the time. So it was this great, great place to work, but also so exhausting because, every night, you know, you work until 1:30 in the morning. Weirdly, it was also a great time for me as a fiction writer, not because I was writing. I wasn't writing at all, but I would read a ton because you would stay up until, you know, you'd work until 1:30 and then, you know, at Wednesday night in Kansas City, there's nothing to do. So you go home but then I'd read fiction. So I read so much those years, you know, at least a novel a week. So it was great to be this sort of really richly engaged reader.
So but I was going to ask, you know, because like, where does fiction fit into all of this in terms of your ambition? Like, when you went off to Missouri to study journalism. Were you harboring ideas about being a fiction writer, or did that come later?
You know, I always liked the idea of writing fiction. I think the pragmatic sense of how I was raised, that I knew if I was going to write and make any money, although it even seems funny now with all my friends who have been laid off, the idea of making money led to journalism, not fiction writing. But at Missouri as an undergrad, I started taking, fiction workshops, and they were great and so important, and I loved them, and being in this community and writing stories. And I still think about the first class that I took with a graduate student who was a teaching assistant who taught that intro fiction writing course, a guy named Dave Sharp. And he actually teaches in a community college outside of Kansas City now. And he was funny and irreverent and had us read cool stuff. And he appreciated what I was doing, and I could always write good sentences. So I took classes like that, and probably took four classes as an undergrad. And it was great and really meaningful. And then when I pursued the MA, that, I applied to five top MFA programs, and I wasn't writing stories. I could write like 10 pages where maybe five of the pages had some cool sentences. So I mailed off those five applications. And then like the very next day, I got five rejections from top MFA programs. So I ended up staying at the University of Missouri to get my MA because, hey, they were my people and they had to keep me, of course. So I wrote fiction there, and I was serious about it then, but I don't know. I don't know how super serious I was. And there are times when I think, looking back, if I had gotten into one of those top MFAs, I don't know if I would have gotten enough out of it at that time, that I wrote and I cared about it. But I still don't think I was writing stories, even though one of my professors, Trudy Lewis, who is a great short story writer, said, hey, these aren't stories. But I don't think I figured it out. So after that, and I think it shows my where I was at, that I read a lot, and I maybe harbored this idea of writing fiction, but I didn't do it, and maybe I would sit down and buy, like a brand new notebook and write one sentence and then close it up and not touch it. And it wasn't until, so I was in Kansas City and working at the Star, and there are parts of it that I loved and met great people and got to be involved in this sports section that really meant a ton to the community and to the people of Kansas City. But it was also sort of soul crushing to be there copy editing and doing the same thing. And there's a cycle to the sports season, which is sort of both great, but annoying. And at the same time that a weird thing happened with me, that I had open heart surgery, and I
what happened?
Yeah, so I had I knew as a kid that I had a heart murmur, but that's what the doctor's just like, oh, he has a heart murmur, it's fine. And then when I was like 27 or so in Kansas City, started feeling this weird, like, fluttering in my chest. And even though now I think it's sort of this writerly cliche to have a bird, like, fluttering in your chest, that's what it felt like. And so I, went to my HMO, and it was actually a nurse practitioner, and I wish I remembered her name, but I don't. And she listened to it. And I think right away that she knew something was off. And then I got sent to a cardiologist, and he sure as hell, as soon as he listened, knew. And so like 3 weeks later, I was having open heart surgery.
But for what? For a murmur?
Yeah. So it's a congenital heart defect called an atrial septal defect, which is essentially a hole in the heart. And it was in a pretty large one, like bigger than a quarter.
My son has that. He's got a slew of health issues, but one of them is that, and that it's actually correctable, though. It's like, if you're going to have a heart defect, an ASD is among the better ones to get, right?
I know. And I've got to tell you, finding out about it and living in the, late 20th century is great, because they sewed it up with Gore-Tex and patched it. And then allegedly the muscle grows over it. Once I got cleared, I'm cleared to do anything. I don't have a cardiologist anymore. And yeah, I have some weird scars, and some, wire wrapped around my sternum, because of course they had to split it in half.
Can't they do that surgery? Cause like they're telling us, like, sometimes this with little kids, can heal on its own. It's not common, but it does happen. But if he still has it like next year, it's like an overnight stay in the hospital. They go in through your leg and they like,
yeah. So, that's, they can do it in this really great non-invasive way. And I bet it's even better now. They tried to do that for me. And apparently I have this weird frame. So I have really skinny forearms, but wide shoulders. And apparently I have really tiny veins and arteries. So they were going to go up through my leg. My arteries were too small, so they couldn't do it. And I had this doctor who was, totally full of himself in this very charming way. Because that's what you want with a heart surgeon. You want to be totally confident.
Right.
So he was telling me after, he's like, so I couldn't do it. So I just, split you open and we did it. So it could have been, a lot less invasive, but my arteries were too small. And I assume now that they can do it with very tiny, tiny tools. So that was some of the problems with splitting it open that probably affected recovery more, that, I had weird, back muscle pains, because of course, when they split open your chest, it rips up your back muscles. And that hurt more than anything having to do with the heart itself. So that was weird, but my recovery was still I was back to work in 6 weeks. Now, like I said, yeah, I'm better than new. In fact, it was, getting the surgery, it was great for playing pickup basketball and things, because hey, my heart didn't have to work twice as hard.
Right. You're not there's not a bird in your chest flapping its wings.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So Brad, how's your son doing then?
It's a complicated story. He's got a slew of health issues. The ASD is probably the least among them. So it's one of those things it sounds cliche, but you take it one day at a time. And he's sweet as can be, but he's got some neurological issues that have that prevent him from using the left side of his body very well. So he can't walk yet, even though he's 2.5. And then, he's got a genetic disorder. He's got epilepsy. He's got all sorts of shit. He got dealt a rough hand.
Right. How are you and your partner dealing with the stresses of that?
Well, I mean, again, it's one day at a time. I think pretty well, but it's hard. You talk to any parent or any person, but especially people who have kids, if your child is imperiled, there's damage or difficulty, it's hard to tolerate, I won't lie. It's really, really difficult, but hopefully what it will do is make us stronger, that's the hope, but that takes work and it takes time. I mean, there's healing involved, and I feel scar tissue is an apt metaphor. It really wounds you when your kid gets diagnosed with stuff. You're just I feel like I'm walking around with a gaping wound, all the time, and waiting for it to sort of scar over. And, it's only been a year and change, and it takes a long time.
Right,
that healing process is, I don't know, maybe for some people, they, the scar tissue happens overnight, but that's not me. It's going to take a little bit of time. I think my wife is the same, but we're working at it, you know, and, I feel like, trying to do the things that one should do to take care of oneself. You know, it's like, what's the metaphor I always use? It's the, when you're on the airplane and they tell you to use, you know, to put the oxygen mask on yourself first before you oxygenate your kids or anybody else, like you sort of have to do that stuff. You have to do self-care, pretty rigorously so that you don't get overwhelmed, so that you don't, you know, find yourself diminished in terms of what you can offer to your other kid or to your partner or to your friends or your family. You know, it's like, it's that challenge. So trying my best. I that's the best I can tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's so true though. The idea that you have to be yourself in order to help take care of others. So man, it sounds hard. Hey, if you ever, down the road want to talk about atrial septal stuff, and of course now for the surgery that I had was prehistoric compared to what they do now, but please holler.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, we'll see. I think we're going to find out next year, probably. He's got like an annual cardiology appointment, you know, where they go in and they sort of, check it out. And I think if we see that it's still there at age 3, I want to say they said age 3 or 4, they'll go in and they'll patch it up.
Great. Great. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm living proof that, yeah, it's in terms of, as you said, like if you're going to have heart surgery, that's the kind you want.
Right.
Yeah.
That's our victory, you know?
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
So what about, this book is not for you? And like, what about writing fiction? I mean, it sounds like you, were working, you know, you're working a day job that was very demanding, and then you have this heart surgery, and was that a pivot point where you sort of admitted to yourself, like, hey, this is something I want to do. I'm aware maybe now more acutely than ever before that, you know, time is ticking. And
yeah.
Was it that kind of thing, that kind of existential, like I'm going to do what I want to do with my life, and I got to find a way to make sure that I'm taking care of the most important things?
Yeah. Yeah. It very much was that was the point then that I decided, hey, I was going to leave Kansas City and transition by finding a different job, in a college town where I could start taking classes. And that's what led me up to Binghamton, New York. And I wanted to take graduate classes. And, at that point I was thinking, even then about a PhD instead of an MFA, because I wanted at least, you know, like 4 or 5 years where I could really be immersed in books. And I thought, hey, I didn't know what I would do after, but I knew I wanted that time. And you know, and I was right around my late 20s. So it was the time to do it. I was single and I decided, yeah, that, okay, I really want to try to write fiction and commit myself to it. And I knew I was ready. And sometimes I talk to my students in that way that, hey, maybe you do love to write fiction, but Bill, hey, you're not writing any fiction. And maybe it's not the time in your life. Maybe you'll do it when you're 60. Well, I think that job and being immersed in reading so much great fiction, and then the heart surgery, it made me think, yeah, I wanted to do something different. So Binghamton the job was hard, and I did not love it, although I loved the people I worked with. But moving to Binghamton and starting to take classes at SUNY Binghamton, now Binghamton University, was so important to me. And I took a great Dickens class with a professor named Philip Roberts. And then he liked me enough to recommend to Jack Vernon that Jack let me into his fiction workshop. And Jack is most famous for his memoir about his brother with who had mental illness and was a hoarder, called A Book of Questions, and also maybe for his really weird, fantastic historical novel called Peter Doyle. He is a great hard ass professor, and he had to write like 4 brand new stories, and he read the hell out of them. And he was awesome. So that semester when I took that class with him, that's when I applied to PhD programs for real, including SUNY Binghamton. And I ended up getting the best deal at to go to KU, University of Kansas. So I went there, and I love that town,
It figures into this book is not for you.
Yeah, exactly. This book is not for you is set in Lawrence, where I got my PhD and spent, 4 years there. And, all the bars are real places. And I spent tons and tons of time at the Replay, which is this great weird punky bar with pinball and live music and a great patio out back with heaters so people can be out there even in late fall. And it's one of my favorite places in the world. So Lawrence, then I went there and wrote fiction and started This Book Is Not For You when I lived in Lawrence in 2003. And then I didn't finish a draft that was the real book until 2014. But Lawrence became this hugely important place to me. And this place that I love, and this place full of weirdos in the middle of Kansas that people think of as this red state. Well, no, Lawrence is so bleeding blue that Governor Brownback calls it a dark area of the state.
it's like the Austin, Texas of Kansas.
Exactly. Yeah. And it has this element of weirdness, like Austin, and this element of art, and this element of community coming together. And some of my best friends in the world still live there. And these are friendships that I made when I lived there. And This Book Is Not For You is, man, did you hear my cat yowl?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
This Book Is Not For You is this sort of ode to Lawrence and to the Replay Lounge, and to the people there, who I love and have changed my life. And when I lived in Lawrence, there was this sort of active group, small but active group of anti-racist skinheads, and a buddy of mine, Ian Ellis, who thinks he is the person whom the character of Uncle X is based on. He was friends with some of those anti-racist skinheads, and I met them through him. And something about them and their mission and their concerns always stuck with me, and so.
An anti-racist skinhead.
Yeah.
So it's like taking on the aesthetics of the racist skinheads, but then flipping it.
Exactly. Yeah. But then flipping it, and they would, you know, they would throw down with someone saying or something racist in a bar, and they also had sort of, the often anti-corporate beliefs as well. Total aesthetics of the skinhead movements with the shaved heads, the outfits you'd imagine. And they believed in it, and believed in being a skinhead, and they believed in stopping racists. And they would fight for it. So I had these impressions and memories and conversations of these people. So it wasn't until probably I left Lawrence that the novel belonged to Neptune, who is the first person narrator and this anti-racist skinhead. It wasn't until I left that he took over the novel. But it belongs to him.
Isn't it kind of interesting that, you know, sometimes when you're working on a creative project, I've read about this and talked to people who've had similar experiences where you know, you don't necessarily see the thing come into focus until you leave the place where it's set, or, you know, a place doesn't come into focus until you're away from it. Was it sort of that thing when you got some distance from Lawrence that suddenly you were able to wrap your brain around it?
I think so. Yeah. I definitely, some of that was that distance, and that after Lawrence moved to Berea, Ohio, right outside of Cleveland, and taught at a liberal arts college. And I think if I were like going to the replay still and going to the shows and seeing the people who inspired characters in the book all the time, that maybe the book couldn't have come to fruition, because they would have been something different, and instead they had to become something imagined in my head, or something that lives on in my head. And I think I could appreciate Lawrence more too, and miss it, and sort of, and maybe working on this book, because it's the kind of thing that I would work on a little bit and then put down and put down for years sometimes. But when I got back into it, I could think about Lawrence and think about this place and imagine it, and pay a strange sort of respects to Lawrence. I think that's part of it. Yeah. That probably if I'd stayed there, I never would have finished a Lawrence novel. I would have written something different. But because I could reach out in that way. And also, I think it was important that Neptune has this really sort of strange, distinct, combative voice that was sort of fun to write in, but also that I wrote it in little snippets. So I think because of that, I could pick it up and put it down and have fun with that voice and remember that voice and hear that voice. And if it had been a more traditional novel, I don't think I would have sustained it. I think it would have died, but instead somehow it stayed alive with me. And then Neptune, you know, he's lived with me for, you know, somewhere up in my brain for, you know, more than a dozen years. So, that distance and that chance to think about place in some new way mattered so much. It's weird though, because now, that I have given myself, and I don't know why or how, but more liberty to write about places where I do live. So I write a lot of Manhattan, Kansas stories now, and I'm working on a new book that's set here in Manhattan, Kansas. And I sort of think about it in a, like a Dickensian way, the way that he wandered London and knew London and talked to its people, and wrote about it in that way. So that's what I'm trying to do with Manhattan. But for Lawrence, and part of it, it's maybe because it's almost, you know, a self myth for me about how important this place was in my life, that I think I had to be away from it to let that myth come alive.
Well, I'll tell you, I congratulate you. It's, I mean, to stick with a novel for more than a dozen years is no small feat, and it's awesome to see it sort of come to fruition. And it's been so fun talking with you, getting a chance to meet you over the transom and getting a chance to shine a little bit of light on your book in the book club. So I appreciate you taking the time, and I wish you all the best on the Manhattan fiction, The Little Apple.
Hey, Brad, thank you so much. And this has been so interesting. And, you know, I'm so grateful for all that you do for writers and readers. It is this terrific, awesome thing. And I've been thinking a ton about indie presses and their editors and the people who start lit magazines and the people who run reading series and the people who run podcasts like you and the Book Fight guys and the people who run independent bookstores. And you people, like, you are fucking awesome and you keep the lit world spinning. And I am so grateful. So thank you for all of that, and thanks for this conversation today.
All right, guys, there you go. That is Daniel A. Hoyt. His novel is called This Book Is Not For You, winner of the inaugural DeZank Fiction Prize, available from DeZank Books, December pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. This Book Is Not For You. Go get your copy today. You can find Daniel online at danielahoyt.com. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle over there is @Dan_Hoyt. Thanks to Kill Rockstars for the music. Be sure to check out killrockstars.com. Don't forget, this podcast has its own official app. It's free. Go get the app wherever you get your apps. It's a great way to listen. If you want to write to me, if you have something to say to me, you want to write me an email, the address is letters@otherppl.com. That's letters@otherppl.com. What am I forgetting? Can't remember. Can't remember what I'm forgetting. It's another way of saying I forgot. I'm an ego inside of a bag of skin. I want very badly to have that experience. You know? I think that's my number one aspiration. Not to like arrive at something, but I want to be one of these people who's like really connected and who can help other people. And like, you know, it's like one of those people that like animals respond very positively to for reasons that are sort of like, you know, mystifying. Or like they like walk up to a donkey and like it just like lays down, you know, lies down. You know what I'm talking about? Not that I want to have some sort of dominion over donkeys, but you know what I'm saying. Like cats, just like birds alight from your shoulders or whatever. I'm very tired. This is what happens when I podcast late at night. Just work a long day. I'm just shot. It's a different beast. I hope you guys enjoy hearing me talk in the throes of sleep deprivation. All right, I think that's it. I think I'm going to sign off now. Holiday Spectacular episode coming up. Thanks to Daniel Hoyt. I'll talk to you guys soon. Okay, thank you.